Impact Policy Podcast. I'm Eric Pfeiffer. Glad to have you along on this really special edition. I've been looking to get this guy on the podcast for a long time and excited to have him. Excited to have him back in Indiana. Indiana native, really, you know, a Boilermaker. Purdue Pete, actually.
Oh, no.
And I like to remind him of that when he comes back to town. Get to see him at some Purdue games every once in a while as well. Ted McKinney is here. Ted, thanks for joining us on the Indiana Ag Policy Podcast, presented by our friends at the Indiana Corn Growers Association and the Indiana Soybean Alliance.
Well, I know those people well, so thank you for your sponsorship, Corn and Soy. It's great to be back, Eric. We're here for our big meeting, so what a hoot we're going to have this week.
And you literally just got off the plane, and you made it possible here for us to chat and go through some policy things here, so thank you for doing that. Let's talk about you here first. You mentioned you're here for your meeting. Mm-hmm. Let's catch folks up on what you're doing here now, and then we'll talk a little bit about your background. You're currently the CEO of the National Association of State Departments of Agriculture.
Right.
So let's fill folks in on what that organization is, what that organization does, and what it is you do for them.
Sure. Well, NASDA is 108 years old. It's one of the oldest of the ag groups in D.C., and it basically represents people in this state who would know Don Lamb. It's the directors of ag, the secretaries of ag in some states, and in other states, it's the commissioner of agriculture. But we represent them and their departments of ag on all things that impact policy, trade, issues, regulations, and we're based in Arlington, so across the Potomac from Washington, D.C. And on any given day, on any given 30 minutes, it could be one issue or another, but we love our members. I think the things that are unique about NASDA is we're nonpartisan, meaning we always have had people of the Democratic Party and of the Republican Party, and we take that as a source of great pride. So nonpartisan, the beauty of that is you can come to a policy meeting. Our policy meeting is annually in February in the Washington, D.C. area. You could sit in on a committee meeting where they're talking and making policy, and you could not tell their political stripes, meaning whether they're a Democrat or Republican. And we love that. And a lot of people are finding their way to our doorstep because here's a group doing real policy on real issues on agriculture, and yet you can't tell their stripes. And so it's a great source of pride for me to be able to dive into that. We cover all 50 states and four territories. Puerto Rico, of course, the U.S. Virgin Islands, those are oftentimes called out, but rarely are Guam or American Samoa on the other side of the world. They, too, are members of ours. So the history is policy, but it's migrated to do a lot more policy, of course, but also trade and issues in between. Another unique thing for all states, less so this one, is that most state departments of ag would look like USDA. All trade policy, all promotion, and all regulations. Here we have the good people at Purdue that do seed, feed, fertilizer, and pesticides. We have the Board of Animal Health, another outstanding entity that does everything with the critters, and I use that word lovingly.
Yeah.
But in most states, those would all be rolled into a Department of Ag. So you can see it's broad, it's vast, it's wide, and I tell you, I love them, and it's just an honor to be with NASDA, a group I've known since 1994.
Well, you being a former director of the State Department of Agriculture here in Indiana, so you used to, correct me if I'm wrong, you used to serve on the board for NASDA when you were with the Indiana State Department of Ag.
Technically not the board, committee chairs.
Committee chair, okay.
But I didn't get to stay here long enough. My goal was to be here much longer, and that got changed. So I never made the board, but was still very, very active, which is sort of my MO, I think.
Yeah. Well, you touched on it there, Ted. I think it's so interesting how this organization works because you're right. I mean, I don't think it's in every state, you've got, you know, a Republican Party in charge, a Democrat Party in charge, and either whether they're appointed, like here in Indiana, where Don Lamb was appointed by the Republican Party to be in charge of the Department of Agriculture, or they're elected in some states. Everyone has an R or a D next to their name somewhere along the way here. But when they come together to create this policy, it really is a nonpartisan organization. Is it you just avoid some of those issues, or is it just
we're trying
to do what's best for agriculture?
We tackle them head on. I think it's that our, well, you know that agriculture gets along. You sort of put all those things beside, and the focus is not a party. It's more a farmer rancher, or the product streams that go from a farm. So in that sense, when your focus is the farmer, the rancher, it doesn't matter if they're in Tennessee or Indiana or Alaska or wherever, you're out for the farmer. And I think that's a big factor. Plus the traditions of agriculture. I mean, even in Washington, D.C. now, we see and we read a lot of divisiveness. But ag really gets along pretty well, even though we have disputes over things like the farm bill and other things. Even then, we close ranks very quickly, and it's just a joy to be in the industry, A, and to be with NASDA, B, because you don't face a lot of that, quite frankly.
Yeah, you mentioned the farm bill. We will get to that, I promise. And oftentimes when you look at that, it's more rural versus urban as opposed to Republican versus Democrat. But again, we'll get to the farm bill here in just a little while.
Okay.
Go back for me here a little bit, Ted. I mentioned you were the Indiana State Department of Agriculture director while you were here.
Right.
Take me back to your roots. Tipton County, right? That's where it all began here in Indiana?
Sure. Well, Tipton County farm kid. So, you know, when you think of that part, you think of soy and corn, and there's always pork and poultry in there, occasionally other things, but so we were lucky to grow up on a very, very productive, very fertile soils of Tipton County. And that's just by matter of God's grace and relatives settling in the right place at the right time. Growing up, to my mom and dad's credit, school and school activities always came first. Now that still left plenty of time to do work on the farm. We didn't escape that, nor did we want to. We loved it. But the joy of being able to throw yourself into 4-H or FFA, in my case, football, student government, student council, all the things that come with high school was just great. And never once was there a conflict. Never once was there a hint that said, can you skip this practice? Nope, it was always do right by that. But you learned hard work. We were lucky in that Tipton, at that time, the Eastern Division headquarters of Pioneer. We went to church with all the Pioneer execs, knew them well, and so Tipton was a very intense seed corn production area. In fact, at one time, Windfall, Indiana, was the seed corn capital of the world because of the number of companies, different companies there. So when we got into the seed corn business, with that comes value-added opportunities like seed corn detasseling, deroguing, eventually custom spraying. This is before the BT, the biotech, came along. So my twin brother Tom and I formed up a detasseling operation. In the first year, I think it was about 24 or so people, but we saw real opportunity because free enterprise system was saving the company so much time and money, and they were willing to share some of that, a goodly portion, with contractors like us. There were several. And so we quickly grew, and I think at the peaks for the next several years, we were about 300 kids, and they came mostly from Tipton, Clinton Central area of Clinton County. Eventually, we tapped into northern Indianapolis and southern parts of Kokomo. And so that became our FFA, Supervised Ag Experience Project in FFA, as you might imagine. My first one was sweet corn, 3 acres of sweet corn, which is work. But detasseling really took over, and we look back, and it was so hard. It was such hard work. But good night, we gave so many kids the opportunity to learn how to work in a safe and fun environment. We made it fun. And we still get Christmas cards and people stopping by to see Tom, mostly, saying, hey, man, I'm so grateful for learning how to work hard. And it was all in the fields of Tipton County. So there was that. Purdue was probably inevitable, although that was never mandated by mom and dad. They once again lived what they practiced, which was you make your own choices. But I would say Purdue football, Purdue basketball, ag was our bag. Why would you go somewhere else, you know? And the Ag Econ program continues to be top five, top three in the country. So why would you go elsewhere? So there was that, and activities continued there. So that was the joy of all of it, was just growing up on a good farm, a great faith-based background, the opportunity to spread your wings, make mistakes, work hard, play hard, make some money along the way, and I wouldn't have traded it for anything.
And it led to you being Purdue Pete and a number of other things there. I mean, it just a great experience there. So,
Well, I would say also pivotal was not just the 10 years of 4-H, but deciding to make a run for a state FFA office. I was so fortunate to have an outstanding team. In fact, I think our team was the last all-male team because women were appropriately coming along, a good thing. And as they figured out what FFA could offer, you know, they were smarter than the guys. They took over, and so women usually prevail in the majority on these teams. But it was a great team, and that sort of opened a lot of doors. And it probably was good because, you know, I had taken my freshman year at Purdue, laid out that next year, and that let Brother Tom move on and do his thing, and I did my thing, and it was just a rich experience there at Purdue as well.
You mentioned Brother Tom, and I have to say, you guys are identical twins. You look and sound identical. I often joke with Tom. I could have him on instead of you. We could get the same thing. And he sometimes says, "Oh, you want the truth now, huh?" When I say that. I have to ask, and this may be the most important question of the entire podcast here, Ted.
Yes.
Has it ever been discussed? The big feature that really sets you two apart is the mustache.
Yes.
That you have.
Yeah.
Has there ever been a discussion about it? This is how people are going to tell us apart. Has he ever been jealous or envious? Maybe he's wanted to grow facial hair, but no, he has to shave the upper lip because that's your thing. Has this ever been a conversation?
Well, we've never had that conversation. I think after getting out of the FFA year, which was wonderful, you test new things when you go to college. Mine was I was going to test the mustache, and I don't know that he wanted to. I don't know that he ever desired to. I would guess that after I did so, it was a point of separation. It helped people understand, okay, who's who. So maybe he wasn't so inclined. But no, we've never looked at it quite that way. It did serve, though, to help people figure us out. So if that's your point, then it worked.
Okay.
Yes.
I'd be curious. Maybe I'll ask Tom the next time I see him. Have you ever, you know, have wanted to and just thought, nope, I can't now. So.
Well, he's quick to say he's the better looking one, which is sort of like putting your arm over on your back and giving a big pat. But... you know, we just let him play. Our most strident objective, my sister, my older brother, and I, is to keep Tom on the farm so as not to embarrass the family too much. But he sneaks out now and then. So
we enjoy chatting with Tom as well.
Yes.
So after all of those experiences, we've mentioned your time with the State Department of Agriculture. Prior to that, your time with Dow AgriSciences.
Right.
That's really what kind of got you into the policy space. Was it that experience?
It was. Tom and I both intended to go back and farm. It's why I minored in agronomy, thinking crops. He minored in livestock, thinking he'd do that. But 1981, if you remember, was not a good time to go back and farm. Now, the farm was always profitable. There was room. We could have done it. But a combination of pretty intense level of activities at Purdue, the FFA experience. My then fiance had not grown up on a farm. She was a willing learner, but I thought, you know, you can always go back and farm from a corporate world or another job, but it's harder to go from the farm. It's harder to do the reverse. So my vision was, I'm just going to try out the corporate world, whatever that looks like, and had all the interviews and selected on Elanco Products Company, which at the time was a very good, strong division of Lilly here based in Indianapolis. It was a vision of, if I ever grew in the company, I'd be in the Indianapolis area, which meant the farm was close by. I could keep those roots, Purdue close by. So a little bit selfishly, I chose Elanco, but what a terrific company it was. And its remnants, Elanco Animal Health, now independent from Lilly, and Corteva, also, of course, independent, were just fantastic places to work. So once again, there was a divine hand looking out for me. So I went into sales, moved to Ohio for two different years, two territories in 2 years, and then up to southern Minnesota for a year, also in sales. And that's when they said, okay, time to come into marketing. So we moved back here. We love Minnesota. If people have not been to Minnesota and seen those black, beautiful soils, oh my goodness, it's a slice of heaven. But this was home. We came back and so started the corporate career. And so I was sort of flitting from one job to the other. Part of it was fun because you feel like, you know, you're doing things. It's always exciting, always new. But you're not living with your mistakes or your victories. You know, you just sort of like a stone skipping across a pond. You don't leave much of a mark. So I told them I really, really wanted to settle down. I want to live with my mistakes and live with my victories. And so they promised. They said, sure, good. So I was a marketing planner, which is a great job because from there you go out to be a district sales manager or go international or go something else. Well, I'll be darned if 9 months later they came to me and said, you can stay. We promised you can stay. But we think you need to know about an opportunity that's been presented by Lilly, the parent. And it was to do media relations, your world, work with people like you, Eric.
Yep.
And my portfolio was all of Elanco, so both the ag chem seed side and animal health. And I also had the environmental issues for all of Eli Lilly and Company, which were really coming on. And we prayed a lot about it because I was leaving home. I was leaving my friends. I was going to the stark, brown, navy-suited world of Eli Lilly and Company. And that's when I found home. I did 4 years there, learned the art of working at least as best I could with the media. And that's when I knew
we're a tough bunch.
Oh, yes. And remember, I mean, it was media all over the world. It was Wall Street Journal, Financial Times, you know, South China, all of those. But it was where I decided I'd found home, which was the government, public affairs, corporate affairs arena. And really never have had a desire to look back. Never, never, never did I want to look back. I had found home.
Yeah. And that leads to the Indiana State Department of Agriculture. Right. And then it leads to your appointment in the Trump administration to USDA Undersecretary for Trade and Foreign Agricultural Affairs, which is, you know, ultimately why, you know, we can talk to you about a number of things, especially trade. Mm-hmm. You know, this... that appointment and going through that process, being part of USDA, just talk about that experience. It had to have been, you know, kind of a, you know, once in a lifetime opportunity to go through that type of process. One and two, just to be part of USDA and kind of carrying Indiana on your back there all over the world.
Well. It was fascinating, and clearly I look back and loved every minute of it and would say even the difficult times were well worth it. I mean, and I hope I say that from a public servant's point of view, because there is really a lot to serving the public in some capacity, whether it was director of ag or undersecretary or whatever. There is just a great deal of honor and pride in being a public servant. And so I enjoyed that when I was the director of ag. How it all came about is still a bit of a mystery. I know that not once but twice, then Governor Pence sort of pulled me aside after a cabinet meeting and said, you might want to think about changing your zip code, meaning come to D.C. Mm-hmm. But it seemed like they fairly quickly turned it over to Sonny Perdue once he was identified and selected as the secretary, because that was where all the interviews were. He used his network, checked you out, as he did all my colleagues. So no matter what, how it came about, it was a great joy. And I'll tell you, it was fascinating, because looking back on all the experiences before that, sort of back to the build, and this is sort of for those that might be in 4-H or FFA or thinking, you know, most of what you learn to do the job as director of ag or the undersecretary, really you learn in 4-H and FFA or similar groups. Activities at a university would also lend into that. Your faith plays in. How ethical are you or not? How truthful are you or not? All that comes from formative years. The study and the art of agriculture comes from a Purdue education, plus, you know, ag class and all the things you learn in high school. But clearly, ag econ was an outstanding background for me, because economics is at the core of trade. Oh, you got to have a product, a pig carcass, you know, popcorn, beef, corn, soy, all the commodities. You got to have that. But the art of how that fits really is as an economic exercise. So loved all that. And I could look back and say everything I could do was going to be the benefit of a farmer or rancher in Indiana or any other state of the U.S.
And now, you know, kind of bringing it back full circle, your time with NASDA now, which was the position you took after that undersecretary role with the new administration coming in. Obviously, your experience with them, being a part of the organization, with your role with the Indiana State Department mm-hmm. of Agriculture, but again, leading this nonpartisan organization with a group full of Republicans, Democrats. You know, Is that what spoke to you, the respect for the organization, one, being a part of it, and two, having that type of trust from members of both parties? I mean, the nonpartisan aspect of it, of we're here for agriculture, is that what drew you to the position?
It was very attractive. Well, the first thing is I knew NASDA pretty well, having been so active as a sponsor from two companies, and then in the director role, you're a member and was very active on committees. So for sure, I really loved NASDA. I did. Now, it wasn't automatic. After I was done with the undersecretary role, I consulted for a while. Some very sage advisors, and you know one of them, Chuck Connor, my mm-hmm. friend A from Purdue and then B in agriculture, they suggested you, if you can afford it, take not just a few weeks, but a few months off. Because as my wife said once, Ted, you're looking pretty haggard, because we did 500,000 miles, international air miles, in 2.5 years. So it was great to decompress, really study what we wanted. I had a couple of wonderful opportunities back in Indianapolis, but I still had a burn to try to work policy. You know, I'm a student of history, and I think of the founding fathers and what they gave up. You know, the British burned many of their estates, took some lives, and good night if those people can give that kind to their service of their country. Was I ready to give up that? And I wasn't. And the reflection that my wife and I had led us to say, we've got to stay, whatever that means. And I'll be darned if my predecessor at the NASDA CEO role, who I was actually on her selection committee when I was in Indiana, you know, I selected Barb Glenn, who is a dear friend. I saw that she announced her retirement, and so I had several people call and say, you ought to look at this. So with some coaxing and with a strong desire and a love of the organization, we took the plunge, and look what happened.
With Ted McKinney, CEO of NASDA, we've gone through the background. It's time to start talking policy, Ted. Let's take a break, and when we come back, let's dig into some of that policy, some of the things that you are focusing on as an organization, and just some other things happening around D.C. Let's take that time out. The Indiana Ag Policy Podcast is brought to you by the Indiana Corn Growers Association, the Indiana Soybean Alliance, and also by
Indiana
Farm Bureau.
There is strength in numbers. That's why the Indiana Soybean Alliance membership and policy and Indiana Corn Growers Association need you. These organizations represent Indiana soybean and corn farmers on critical and regulatory issues affecting their industry. Along with support from the national organizations, National Corn Growers Association and American Soybean Association, the Indiana members help determine public policy positions on critical issues, including farm bills, trade policy, and ethanol and biodiesel legislation. Become a member of Indiana Soybean Alliance membership, Indiana Corn Growers Association, or both. Visit incornandsoy.org to select a membership. That's incornandsoy.org.
At Indiana Farm Bureau, we serve tree farmers, goat farmers, and in fact, all farmers. With over 250,000 members, Indiana Farm Bureau represents a broad range of farmers and puts power in your collective voice. You also get advice from our subject matter experts, more affordable health plan options, and support for youth programs statewide. So whether you grow soybeans or strawberries, membership means you'll be heard. Become a member today at infb.org.
And we're back on the Indiana Ag Policy Podcast. Eric Pfeiffer here with Ted McKinney. And Ted, we've been hearing some rumors. Zippy Duval was actually in Indiana this past week and had the opportunity to have dinner with him the other night, and he's telling me there's renewed optimism. This farm bill that, let's be honest, we've been talking about it since 2018 when the last farm bill got done.
That's
how this tends to work. There's some pressure mounting now on lawmakers on Capitol Hill, the ag lawmakers, the four corners of agriculture, if you will. There's some pressure mounting here to maybe get this thing done during a lame duck session. Are you hearing that same kind of pressure? Or what are you hearing? We're also hearing maybe if we can't get a farm bill done, we can get something attached to another bill to get something done for farmers now, because the stakes are just too high and things just aren't looking great for farmers right now in the way of commodity prices and everything else. What's the latest you're hearing out there in D.C.?
Well, first, if you were Zippy Duval, he's one great American, and Farm Bureau, what a great organization. I'm still a card-carrying member, so I love that. No, he's right. There has a change has come about, and I've wondered what was it. I think it comes down to two things. First, there have been some very good studies, including those from USDA's own analysis, that suggests the economy on the farm is bad and getting worse, or at least it doesn't look very good going into next year. And that really means that what was a good 2018 farm bill, it still has many properties that are serving farmers and consumers well, but boy, some changes were and are necessary. So I think that was one catalyst that brought everybody back together. The other one is that hunger in many sectors continues to rise. It's surprising because we're out of COVID. You'd think we're back to it. I think it has to be this rate of inflation and the stingy rate of food inflation that has stayed there that combines to say, whoa, we got to do something. So, we have heard from themselves that the so-called four corners, the chair and ranking member of the House and Senate Ag Committees. So this would be Senator Stabenow and Senator Bozeman, chair and ranking, and Congressman G.T. Thompson and his colleague from Georgia as chair and ranking, that they have come together and met. Now, no resolution yet. You'd have seen fireworks. You'd have seen surprises. You'd have been 4th of July if we'd seen that. But at least they met, because they had not been meeting. Equally as important is the chiefs of staff for all four of them have met, and we've seen that publicly. So that's a very, very good sign. Now let's don't bet big money on this yet, because we haven't seen it. We have also heard, I haven't seen validated or heard from themselves, but we've heard there was a decision that they didn't want to put the farm bill in with an omnibus where you shove through just loads and loads and loads of things, but that they want it to be a stand-up, upright, standalone bill. Well, that's all really good news. Now, for those that might be thinking before the election, I don't think that's going to happen. It would be the so-called lame duck session. So anything can change, but I do think it's a good sign, and I regret to say that what really drove it was just the incredibly poor forecasts of profitability and in some cases, need for nutrition and hunger.
Well, you talk about that report that came from USDA, and Zippy discussed it with me the other night. 23%, I believe, less farm income is what we're talking about. And he looked me straight in the eye, and he said, how would you do with 23% less income in your house?
No.
And I said, that probably wouldn't go over very well, especially with the cost of what's happening at the grocery store. I mean, that's facts. So, you know, when you put it that way, that's kind of what's happening right now. And I asked you this question the last time we spoke when I didn't have a microphone in front of your face. And I wanted to ask you because it's been on my mind, and I don't want to place blame anywhere. I understood the tactic and I understood the strategy. But I wondered, and maybe what's happened, while it seems, you know, a bad way to put it, maybe it's a good thing. But I asked you the last time we saw each other during the state fair, is it the fault of the farmer and the way we approached this farm bill, is it our fault that this thing hasn't been done yet? Just the way that the message has gone of, you know what, the 2018 farm bill was a good one. The 2018 farm bill, you know, do no harm. Let's just copy and paste that thing. Let's just get that one done again. Mm-hmm. Has that been the excuse for not getting a new one done? And, you know, I get it. But since, you know, we started talking that way, commodity prices have gone way down. If we had just copied and pasted the last one, would we have been in a good spot now for these prices if we had just done it right away? I don't know the answer to that either.
Oh, I'm going to refrain from really putting blame anywhere. I think sometimes it's just a matter of circumstances. For sure, the farmer numbers, you know, continue to go down, so it takes all of us, the entire industry, everybody who understands food and agriculture, to keep that voice. I would add to it that I think COVID and the remnants of people wondering whether they're going to have food, and if they were going to have food, how much, and what was the food going to be, left great uncertainty. So that probably ramped up the whole nutrition aspect, which would be SNAP and WIC and farm to school, farm to food bank kinds of programs. There's always new faces too on the committees, and that's not an indictment. It just says there's different voices who carry different passions with them. So no, I don't think there's fault to be laid. I bet if you went back even with the 2018 and the 2014 Farm Bill and looked at headlines, there was disagreements ahead of time there, and we tend to forget them because we close ranks so quickly and we celebrate what we have. And I'll hearken back to, my 1973 Oldsmobile Cutlass Supreme. I loved that car. Why do I need a new one if I really love that old car? It got me where I needed to go. Do I need the bells and whistles? Well, sometimes you don't realize you may need a new car with its safety features, its backstop, insurance kinds of things. So a pretty poor analogy, but it might explain why we did, and we still do look favorably upon the 2018 Farm Bill. But I think what came into real focus recently, very recently, is love the 2018 Cutlass Supreme, Ted, or we love the 2018 Farm Bill, but there's enough that's changed. We've got to dive in, and we've got to dive in now. I think there's a lot to that.
Yeah. And again, I understood the strategy. I'm not looking to place blame anywhere. I feel like maybe from a lawmaker's standpoint, that was kind of the excuse to just keep kicking this can down the road. But now I think the rhetoric, you know, from the farmer's side, from some of these farm organization side, it is starting to get a little bit more, hey, it's got to happen now. It's way too late now. And I think that's a good thing, and that's where some of this pressure is coming from.
We should probably also look at what else was being attempted to be brought to the House and Senate floor. I mean, it's been a pretty interesting, 2 years with some of the different factions, and you've got to get floor time.
Yep.
And I can understand a Senate Majority Leader, Mr. Schumer, or a House Speaker only wanting to bring it forward unless it was going to make it. So, those factors play into. But whatever it is, I'm pleased that we're seeing a goal of maybe getting this thing done and getting it done independently. I'm excited about the possibilities. Not the certainty, but the possibilities.
And hopefully we can see something come up in a lame duck session and not just kicked into next year, because again, we could see a lot of new faces,
right,
and have to explain this whole farm bill to a lot of those faces.
That's right.
If we push this into 2025. So
that's right.
That's the hope, is that something can get accomplished in a lame duck session. Ted, some other issues that are happening out in D.C. And I know, as we look at the larger landscape of agriculture, I think that, if you ask someone today, what's the number one priority, they'd probably say farm bill. Mm-hmm. But, once we get that thing taken care of, I think if you were to just overall say, what's the number one issue in agriculture, I think the answer would really be labor. I really think that across the board, that would probably be the number one answer if this farm bill thing wasn't in play. Would you agree with that? And does anyone really have the answer to this?
Well, yes. If you're looking at our farmers as the customer and what is going to help them come along, you'd have to say the economy, and an economy that brings them better prices, which then leads to labor. But yes, labor. Before we go down the labor line, and I want to come back to that because it is very real and it's very specific to a lot of our farmers, I still think the biggest one globally is food security. We've got the world hollering very loudly about climate change, and well they should. The climate is changing. And those who can afford food are directing the policy. I'll look squarely at Europe. Farm to fork was going to mandate all kinds of things that would have reduced productivity significantly. And let's not forget that we've got a lot of people in the world that are still very, very hungry. And the joy I brought in my days growing up on a farm, and we still do. I still have 4-H and FFA speeches I kept talking about how proud I was as a farm kid that our farm would produce food for 60 other families or 60 other people. I forget what it was. Now it's 155, 160. So if we don't take care of the food security issues around the world, holy smokes, all hell is going to break loose. And it's already getting close to that based on the signals we hear from those that don't like democracies and the like. So globally, I start with food security and the need to continue productivity, always food safety and food security and food quality, always there. Now let's get back to the farm. Yes, labor. My goodness, the dairy farmers are just crying the blues because they can't get or keep people. Certainly produce, fruits and vegetable processing plants like we have in this state, Indiana Packers, Tyson, the list goes long. And to have legal, you could find illegal, but people in ag are ethical. They want to play by the rules. So yes, we've got to find a solution, and unfortunately, what's been going on the border has really, driven a deeper wedge in there. But maybe we're coming out of that. Numbers are down significantly. Maybe we're coming out of that, and we can come to some joint, happy, bipartisan solution.
So, is there a solution? Like, in a perfect world, I mean, has NASDA, have members come together and been like, all right, Here's the solution. Go take this somewhere and let's have someone agree on it. I don't know that anyone's put forward the actual perfect solution and said, all right, lawmakers, let's get around this, because lawmakers have the ideas of their own.
Well, I'll answer in part. If your solution is exclusively around guest workers from other countries, that's a tough one to predict. And I would say we do not have a solution it's going to have to come over coming months and years. But I think we do have a solution, and I give credit to my members. The former two presidents wanted to focus on workforce development, not guest labor, workforce development as something we could focus on, because we are losing a lot of our people that might have grown up in and around agriculture to go to other occupations. Let's keep them. It's one reason why I'm actually staying around a couple days, and on Thursday evening I'll have dinner with Ivy Tech in Terre Haute, and Friday morning speak to, I'm told, 600 to 900 people who are having some contest, welding and other things. It's not like an FFA convention, but maybe it's a version of, to try to encourage them to look at and stay in agriculture. Because look at it, you can go to any occupation. You can be a lawyer and be an ag. You can be an accountant, be an ag. You can be a sales rep, be an ag. Certainly agronomists, veterinarians, pathologists, any occupation you can find in ag. So as NASDA, we're focusing within. We want to try to get and keep those students, whether they were in ag or not. Certainly we want to keep everybody that was in ag. We need all of them and more. So let's go find people who didn't know ag, introduce them to ag, and see if we can keep them. And that's what we're after. And we're focusing a great deal, always on the universities, the land grants, for example, always on 4-H and FFA and Ag Future of America, which is more your collegiate type program, always those. We want to double down on them. But so too, we're going after the junior colleges with people like Ivy Tech as probably the poster child. What Sue Elsperman and her team, that's my old boss, excuse me, my young boss, Sue.
Former
boss. Yeah, yeah. What they're doing with those ag programs in Terre Haute, in West Lafayette, and other places is incredible. Let's go land those people and bring them in to pick your career. So we're going to spend time there because we think it's gettable. We can get it. It just needs to be more focused in the speaking. And my goodness, our members in their bully pulpits have a lot of sway, a lot of voice, a lot of clout, a lot of people like you paying attention. Meanwhile, we'll work. Now, we were very close on a bill that would really have helped, not fixed entirely, but have helped fixed partially the labor issue. It was the omnibus bill in December of 2022. If we could have just gotten to keep that in as opposed to stripping it out, man, it was pretty good. It was pretty good. And I'll remind people that the differences aren't so stark. We do need seasonal labor. Think fruits and vegetables. But for our dairy farmers in a growing area, our pork farmers, you need year-round labor that's guest. Well, the law is written such that you got a few months, and that's it. Let them stay. They can work their way through. Surely there is something that our good friends in both the Democratic and Republican Party would find acceptable. I think there is. So we've got to keep at it. And if ag can bring the forces to bear as they did here in the last few weeks to get going, maybe we can coalesce and really get something done on labor.
If they're not causing any problems in those few months that they're here, why can't they stay and help year round? I mean, it's just not making sense. If they're providing value,
right,
why can't they continue to provide value?
Yes. And for sure, many industries need labor. I mean, there's a lot. I mean, when Tom and I were in our last few years of detasseling, we were finding that a lot of kids just didn't want to go work that hard. Call us getting weak, call us what you want, but the reality is not a lot of people want to go out and do that kind of labor. And so guest labor, whether it's a few months, a year, or a few years, is a great answer. But we better grow our own, homegrown, to do a lot of the work. Not all the work, but a lot of the work as well.
And I do want to go back to your point and really put an exclamation point on it. I've heard this so many times from Indiana farmers. They do want to find a legal,
yes,
workforce.
Oh, yes.
They want to do things within the law.
Yes.
But they love that legal work. Like they love having that help on the farm. They do want to do it within the law.
That's right. I love the ethics. I love the transparency of the agricultural industry writ large. Well, just to take that to a macro level, I mean, one of the reasons that we just haven't done so much with Africa over the last many decades is that there was so much corruption and graft at the ports that U.S. companies who know the law, never mind that you may be in a port in Timbuktu, as a U.S. company, you were not allowed. You were legally disallowed from doing that, paying off someone. That's why we didn't go there. So good for the ethics of these many, many companies, farmers, whoever's trying to export there. That's changing. That's good. Mm-hmm. There's been a lot of change in the ethics of foreign countries. So you're right. We want to be ethical. We want to be transparent. We want to live by the law. And gosh darn it, tough to do. Tough to get people when you're going to be pretty strict on that rule.
Yeah. Ted, let's talk trade.
Yeah.
This is right up your alley here. This is your forte. How are we doing on trade? I think based on where soybean prices are, soybean farmers would say not very well. Yeah. What say you?
Well, let's go back and first look at some of the latest data, which says we're now a pretty solid net importer of food. I would urge my friends and people listening or reading or whatever they're doing with this to be a bit careful with that, because we import some really high value things. And the first thing I race to is wines and spirits, whiskeys, wines, which are very high value. And if we import more and more and more of that, and the counter is exporting soy or corn, well, there's a lot of difference in the value there. So that's one reason for that. It's not the only reason. We do have to get after trade, but it's one reason. Another one is the strength of the dollar. When the dollar is strong, man, oh man, on one hand, that's great because it says we have a healthy economy, but you get screwed every time because people are going to go elsewhere. So there's that factor. But we mustn't forget as well that we, for the last many, many years, this is not a last 3.5 years, this is many years, we haven't put into finding those trade agreements that we need. And we can and we should. Some of it's a manpower issue, never mind the politics. That doesn't have anything to do with it. It's just the horsepower to go do that. Sometimes, you know, there's a desire to do a big multilateral, and that means you got to get every piece perfect. For example, the TPP is one that ag looks back on and says, gosh, how did we let that go? Well, the truth is I heard leadership in both chambers of the Congress saying it's dead on arrival. And the big factor was autos. The auto language was apparently left a gaping hole for Japan and China to really take huge segments of our auto market. Ag was pretty good. So maybe is that to say that multilaterals should not be our focus? I'm not saying that. I think you can get it, but it says, boy, you better cross every T properly and dot every I, because you don't want, like in this case, autos to preempt what apparently we think most of us was a pretty good ag piece. So then it goes to bilaterals. Well, that just takes a lot of time. And that means the Congress has to approve and give fast track authority to the president. Well, that's not easy to do. And then I think a big one is ag lost the narrative. It's pretty clear that a lot of jobs went outside the borders here. Manufacturing, widgets, autos, steel, not so much ag. So when the narrative became we were exporting jobs en masse, and therefore anything that is exported becomes the boogeyman, then you get screwed. So a lot of it's on us in ag. You know, I think the reshoring is going to fix that. I think if as jobs keep coming back, and I'm talking about widgets, steel, autos, all those things, everything outside of ag, it's going to be better. But we're going to have to go through the trough here where the U.S. recognizes again that that trade generally is something that is good and can, if you're a union member, lift you up, not tear you down. And for sure, we in ag have got to be leading the way because ag is very important long term. So I think it's a combination of things that are presenting us with our woes. We got to work on it, though.
I think, you know, for farmers, you've got to remember, one, you know, those deals, one, they're not happening. So there's that. We also do have, you know, for the trade deals that we have,
yes,
we're experiencing some hiccups with infrastructure at the moment. You know, you look at the Mississippi, we've got some low water levels right now. We've got some potential strikes with the East Coast longshoremen. I mean, there are just a number of things. We almost had a strike with Canada and their rails.
Correct.
So
that's right.
So in addition to just some of these trade deals not happening, we're talking about infrastructure issues as well. It's just kind of hitting farmers from a lot of different angles right now.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of frustration, yes, but we can't be frustrated all at one thing or all at one person. It's everywhere. It's everything.
We have to break it down and then tackle it one piece at a time. You know, some people I've heard say to me, well, why don't we just go do an ag trade? Just an ag only. Oh, gosh, that is a brilliant idea. The catch is that in the world of trade, ag is always last for a reason because it's so difficult and it's so much more cultural than widgets or steel or things. So not to say we shouldn't go try it, and we were trying some, you know, and I loved working on that kind of thing. I would have to say one other thing is that the world, for many reasons, not just because of things going on here, but the world in general has become more protectionist. COVID did not help us with that. At a time when exports were normally the theme, country presidents, country leadership were saying, hold on, I'm gonna protect what I got, I'm gonna make sure I'm gonna feed my people, and we too did some of that. And that's understandable a bit. So we gotta work out of that thinking before we're going to be able to get folks saying, no, trade is really essential. It keeps peace around the world. I mean, that's why the feudal lords, the son of the feudal lords of one country married the daughter or the princess of a feudal lord in another country. It was to keep the peace and trade. So we've gotta go back to the roots. I think we're going to get there. I think we're starting to see some of the signs. And I'll leave you with one other thing. I am no longer using the words free trade. I read Bob Lighthizer's book. It's a great read. You need to read it. People need to read it. There are so many countries that subsidize, put up barriers, deny things, some cases lie. The best we can hope for is fair trade, because usually there's something in the mix that denies it from being just straight up free trade, like I think so many of us in America would like. So I'll settle for fair trade. Fair trade's good. I'll go with that.
Yeah.
So that's the what I'm introducing in everybody's lexicon here.
Well, and you know, I'm sure you have plenty of stories that you know, one day maybe you'll write a book about, and you know, can't share with us now, but I mean, you've talked about countries like Europe and how difficult it is to try to get some of our products over there just because of their stances on how some of these, I mean, this has got to be tough to try to negotiate with folks like that, and I'm sure there are similar stories across the world who, you know, we grow a fantastic product here in the United States, and some folks just may not realize it or want to recognize it.
That's right. Well, you mentioned Europe. First, I love Europe. I mean, if I was to go on vacation, it's one of my favorite places. So writ large, I love Europe. I don't like their policies. And a lot of this was because they were granted such reprieve as was appropriate right after World War II. They had to get back on their feet. And their system was set up so that they wanted to keep a lot of farmers, and there was enough money in the subsidies that are so prevalent there that you could keep small farmers. Here in the U.S., there was not that. I remember as a kid, I remember talking to aunts and uncles that wanted to get out of the business. The workload, they were aging out, kids weren't coming back. So we were thrilled to be able to go farm relatives' land. And so the fact that we are a much larger, greater critical mass, you know, Canada, the U.S., Brazil, other countries, farming enlarged then got way more efficient. Europe was willing to pay the heavy subsidies to keep the small and highly, much less efficient. Doesn't mean it's wrong, it just means that was the culture, that was the path they chose. So the world didn't call them and stop a lot of the subsidies when they should have, maybe mainstream, and every country is going to judge on their own merits whether they did right or wrong. I'm glad we chose the path we did because we're providing an excellent, safe, quality product, and it's less it's at a reasonable expense for the world to buy. I'm proud of our system, and I'll stand by it.
Ted, what other issues out in D.C. are you monitoring, NASDA monitoring, anything else at this point?
Yeah, we have different priorities than a lot of our commodity group friends, not because we don't support corn, soy, beef, pork, poultry, dairy, all of them. No. We are second in line. We are very supportive of all of them. But they have an organization like the corn growers, one of your sponsors. They have the soy growers, and those folks usually are the first in line defending that crop, as well they should. So what that does is gives us a chance to look at some other things that are equally as important. And I'll raise the question, the issue of research. There is plenty of research going into all the things that farmers buy, but it's an applied research. It's a better germplasm. It's a better biotech. It's adding gene editing. The core research is slipping in the U.S. Monies that the government of China and other countries put in, we're now like fifth to eighth somewhere in the world. We used to be number one by an enormous margin. In our case, we're seeing laboratories in our universities from the 1950s and 60s, now they're made over. But when you have a bright kid coming to college and they go over to engineering and say, whoa, this AI stuff is cool, and everything bright and shiny, and then they're being recruited to a lab from the 60s and 70s, although made over and still produces great product, what do you think they're going to choose? You have to keep up. For better or worse, you have to keep up. So we would like to see more money in the farm bill to upgrade facilities, and most of those are universities. A few of them are state governments, so we're not trying to be selfish here. We're trying to be unselfish. And get the core research that brings along hybrid seed like it did in the 20s and 30s. That was not a corporate or an industry-led effort. That was right out of universities. Gene editing, CRISPR, I think one company was involved, and there were three universities. That's stuff that could change the world. So for that reason, research is a big one. We're still very involved in nutrition, though farmers and ranchers are the lenses we look through. Our members are very supportive of SNAP and women, infants, and children, and the farm to food, farm to school, farm to food bank type programs. Labor is very much in there. There are a few others, inputs and technology. You know, the world seems to think that getting rid entirely of pesticides is a good idea. Certainly, a softer footprint is better. But those are the products that have brought us great efficiency and low cost and safer and more high quality food, not less quality. So defending those kinds of things and looking for the next wave of innovation, biologicals, for example, seems to be the next wave. Still too early to say whether they are the better mousetrap or not. But all those things are ones that we dive into and try to find our way to support. Because remember, we're co-regulators. We take the handoff from EPA and USDA and FDA in many cases, and then the regulation hits the rubber hits the road here.
I assume you're watching some of these insecticide strategies, and so you're watching those very closely. You know, I don't think any of those are going away, regardless of what administration. Those things are coming. It's just a matter of how are they going to be finalized, and then ultimately, you know, a conversation and a question that keeps popping up that I keep hearing is, how's it going to be enforced? Who's going to be policing this?
Well, that's what our members do. That's where the rubber hits the road.
Yeah.
No, our members have been very clear. You know, we want to abide by the law. They'll enforce the law. And for goodness sake, I give EPA a lot of credit for trying to make it work. You know, they've lost some lawsuits, got to comply. So they're trying their best. Now, I'm introducing some new language called the endangered farmer. I'm all for, and farmers and agriculture writ large are all supportive of protecting endangered species. But remember, the Endangered Species Act says nothing about risk benefit. Whatever it takes to save that endangered insect, bug, weed, vegetable, grass, if it's endangered, it is to be protected. Got it. I understand that. But is that at the cost of having our food productivity? Is that at the cost of driving lots and lots of farmers out of business? I'm not sure that's what the people who wrote that law were thinking. Okay, so we'll find some happy medium. We will find a way. I am confident we'll find a way. And I love how EPA is doing its best to do that. Certainly all the commodity groups, Farm Bureau for sure is in the thick of that. We're in the thick of that, trying to find what is that amicable solution. But we've done it before. We'll do it again. It'll just be a bumpy road to get there.
Ted McKinney, I thank you for jumping off the plane here in Indy and coming and chatting with me here and doing this Indiana Ag Policy podcast. I really appreciate the time and always a pleasure to chat with you and talking policy. It seems like every time we get together, we talk policy. I just get a chance to hand you a microphone this time and chat through it. So thank you very much. I really appreciate it.
Well, it's my pleasure, and thank you, and thanks to Hoosier Ag Today for the product you bring. I don't think there's really any days I miss opening up Hoosier Ag Today in the morning. So thank you very, very much.
Appreciate it, Ted. And, you know, we'll get together again here some other time and talk through it. And have a good week in Indianapolis here for your NASDA conference. We'll keep up to date and be sure to come visit you guys while you're here.
So we'll see you around. Thank you.
That's another edition of the Indiana Ag Policy Podcast. We thank you for joining us. Again, the Indiana Ag Policy Podcast is presented by the Indiana Corn Growers Association and the Indiana Soybean Alliance, and also by Indiana Farm Bureau.